Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by historian and sociologist Stephanie Kuntz, author of The Way We Never Were, American Families in the Nostalgia Trap, and A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. The topic of her talk will be Courting Trouble, The Past and Future of Marriage in America. Ms. Kuntz's remarks were given as the 2011 Richard Dean Winchell Lecture, sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of History. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 12, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Sharon Wood, Chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Stephanie Kuntz is a historian who values families. For some three decades, she has studied the complexity and variety of families in the United States today and in the world through history. And she has been a tireless advocate for public policy supporting families as Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families, which she helped found, and as a writer publishing scholarly research for general audiences in venues ranging from the New York Times to the Times of London to the Wall Street Journal, Salon, the Washington Post, Newsweek, Harper's. I could go on and on, but I'll stop there. Professor Kuntz is author of the award-winning book, Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. She also wrote the very widely used The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, and The Way We Really Are, Coming to Terms with America's Changing Families, among other books. Her most recent book was released just in January, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s is, I'm sure, available at bookstores everywhere. And she'd like me to mention that. A former Woodrow Wilson Fellow, she has testified before Congress on family policy issues and appeared on The Colbert Report, The Oprah Winfrey Show, Fresh Air with Terry Gross, apparently more than once, and The O'Reilly Factor. Tonight, her talk will be Courting Trouble, The Past and Future of Marriage in America. Please join me in welcoming Stephanie Kuntz.
Well, thank you very much. I've been very much enjoying Omaha. I had the opportunity to get a tour of it, where the stockyards used to be, and really see some of the tremendous history of this place. But I'm going to go back even further than the stockyards tonight and see if I can take us through a gallop through history and up through the present and marriage. You know, everybody knows and that marriage is not what it used to be, and everyone is quite right. But there's a lot more confusion about what marriage used to be, because a lot of the things that some people think of as traditional in marriage were actually quite recent inventions, whereas a lot of the things that people think of as new are actually quite traditional. For example, a diversity of families, or single-parent families or step-parent families, which were actually much more prominent in the past than they are today. Step families, because of the high death rates, it wasn't until 1970 that a child became more likely in America to lose a parent to divorce than to lose a parent to death before they reached 18. And in terms of real diversity in families, you would have to, it makes some of the cultural variations in history make today's diversity look very tame. For example, we're always getting into these debates about the traditional marriage of one man, one woman. Well, actually, if you look back in history, the form of marriage more preferred by many culture by cultures than any other through the past, and the one most frequently referred to in the first five books of the Bible, was one man, many women. And there were also marriages of one woman, several men. There were also interesting variations on marriage, such as the ghost marriages that were common in parts of Asia, particularly in China, where if you wanted to make an alliance with another family, and you engaged your children at a very early age, and if the one of the children died, you went ahead and married the surviving child to the ghost, and it was called marrying a tablet. There was a little tablet there you could marry. One interesting switch on this was in the 20th century, as women began to get access to the developing silk, the textile industry in China, many women did not want to obey the Confucian's rule of the three obediences. So where in childhood you obey your father, once you marry you obey your husband, and when your husband dies you obey your son. They really would have preferred to stay single, especially since they could support themselves. And so historians taking the oral histories of these silk workers found that these women, their families would not allow them to remain single. But they were open to the idea of a ghost marriage, so these women said that they would actually keep their ear to the ground, and as soon as they heard of an eligible bachelor who had died in a neighboring village, they would try to get there first to see if they could get his hand in marriage. So there's certainly been a lot of variations in marital forms. Marriage has not always been sanctified by church or state. Through most of history, it was a private arrangement by families. And in fact, when the in Rome, it was simply your in the ancient Roman Empire, your intent to be married was what determined whether you were married or not. And in fact, it was also true that you made private decisions to divorce, and to so much so that there was once a ruling by an emperor that if you said "I divorce you" in the heat of anger, it was not finalized until you said it three times the next day. So there was a lot of when the Christian Church first began to emerge, one of the early popes suggested that perhaps they should make a rule that marriage should be, to be valid, you had to be married in church. His advisors immediately pointed out that this would make 90% of the Christianity illegitimate. So the Christian Church took the position that if you had said you had exchanged words of consent out by the apple tree, you know, by the haystack, if you had exchanged them in the present tense, you were married. If you'd exchanged them in the future tense, you had to have sexual intercourse to make the marriage valid. But if you had exchanged them in the present tense, you were married. Now, in 1215, the church made a distinction between illicit marriage and an illicit marriage. Illicit marriage had to be announced in advance, the banns read. It had to have a dowry, which implies parental approval, and we'll get back to that in marriage. And it had to take place in a church. But interestingly enough, and this might be a potential way around all this debates we've been having about same-sex marriage, the church said that an illicit marriage was equally binding with all the rights and obligations. So they went ahead and continued until the 16th century to treat that as a binding one. What about things like, we tend to think that, oh my goodness, the modern generation invented sex and sexual freedom. Actually, through most of history, there were lots of sexual arrangements. My favorite example, the one that seems most shocking to us, and it's not one I hasten to say that I'm advocating, is found among the Bari of Venezuela and several other small-scale societies in South America, where people believe that any man that has sex with a woman while she is pregnant contributes something of his substance to the child. And so women often take lovers during their pregnancy. And after, when the child is born, the midwife asks her to name every man she slept with, and the midwife will then go to these men and say, "You have become a father." And now, in our society, this would probably lead to some very mixed up children. That's why I'm not advocating it. But in those societies, it actually was a huge advantage to the child, because the men took these responsibilities seriously. They contributed a share of their hunting and their fishing, and a child who whose mother had been promiscuous during the pregnancy was 2.5 times more likely to survive to adulthood than a child whose mother had been monogamous. So there's a lot of variety there. And in fact, when people talk about the modern, one of my students some years ago wrote an essay complaining that people nowadays don't respect the marriage vowels. Which I actually loved, you know, because I owe you, you know. But what she meant was that people aren't faithful anymore. And, as a historian, I had to goggle about that because through most of history, there have been many societies in which neither women nor men have been expected to be faithful. But through most of Western history, men have not been expected to be faithful to their wives. In fact, it was so common for men to have mistresses or to go to prostitutes, that in the 18th century America, we have letters with men and diaries, with men bragging to their wives' brothers about their mistress or their sexual exploits, or complaining that they had acquired the pox, you know, from a prostitute they visited, and thinking nothing of it. You know, today, of course, you really wouldn't do that normally to your wife's brother or father, but that was very common then. And as late as the late 19th century, there was an epidemic of venereal disease in respectable middle-class homes because of the venereal diseases that men brought home because they visited prostitutes so much. So there's all sorts of things that we tend to think of as new that are not new at all, including, for example, the co-provider families. Through most of history, the male breadwinner family is sort of a fluke in history. It wasn't until the 1920s that a bare majority of children grew up in families where either the man and the woman were not working together in a small business or farm, or the kids themselves were not out at work helping to support the family. That family form receded in the 30s and 40s, roared back in the 50s and 60s, and as you know, is now gone. 70% of American children for 70% of American children, every adult in the home works outside the home today. So the male breadwinner family was actually pretty much a historical fluke. Let me see. I had other examples. I could go on forever of the things that we think are new and are not new. Divorce was quite common in many hunting and gathering societies in Indonesia in the 1940s and 50s. They had higher divorce rates than the U.S. had, even at its height. And by the way, most people don't recognize that divorce rates have been falling in the United States since their high in 1980-81. But, for example, among the Shoshone Indians, if a woman wanted a divorce, all she did was put her husband's belongings outside the teepee, which belonged to him. And when he came back, he said, oh, got to move on here. In traditional Japanese society, divorce was more of a male prerogative, and a man could get a divorce by writing a letter of exactly 3.5 lines, you know, sort of like a haiku, a divorce haiku. A woman had to put in 2 years at a special temple before she could get it. So divorce, all of these things were known. In that sense, there's very little that is new. So what is new about marriage today? Well, one thing that is new is that marriage is supposed to be about love and mutual commitment. For most of history, for thousands of years, marriage for love was rare and it was highly disapproved. In ancient India, and up until recently, India still has a majority of arranged marriages, falling in love was considered an antisocial act. People still get, kids still get killed, as a matter of fact, for eloping for love in parts of India. In China, the word love connoted a dangerous, illicit kind of relationship. It wasn't until the 1920s that a group of intellectuals decided that they needed to invent a new word that had more positive connotations about love between married couples. And even in the 16th and 17th century, although Christian moralists talked a lot about the love in marriage, they very explicitly said that you should marry someone you could learn to love. And they cautioned against using such things. They cautioned wives, for example, against using fond nicknames for their husband because that would undermine the authority relationships on which marriage was supposed to depend. So the the idea that people, that young people should choose their own mates and that they should do so on the basis of love was something that was considered outrageous for thousands and thousands of years. It was not until the late 18th century. I mean, of course, that doesn't mean that people didn't want, young people have always dreamed of being able to marry whom they loved, but it's no accident that most love stories throughout history were tragedies. Marriage was not the happy ending to a love story. It was the unhappy ending to the love story when you went ahead and married whom your parents wanted you to. Because for thousands of years, marriage was not about love. It was not about the relationship of the two individuals. There's this big debate about why marriage was invented. When I was going to school first in the 1960s, the prevailing story was that marriage was invented so that men could take care of women. Women offered sexual exclusivity in return for men providing doing the hunting for them and taking care of them. Then in the 70s, a bunch of feminist anthropologists came along and they said, who was taking care of the women while the men were out hunting then, you know, protecting them from the saber-toothed tiger or whatever it was. And furthermore, how do we explain the fact that in many societies, marriage seems to be a way of men accumulating labor and using the labor of women and their children to enhance their social status. So they came up with the other opposite theory, that marriage was invented to oppress women and to protect men. I have come to believe that the invention of marriage had nothing to do with women, being protected by men or women being oppressed by men or vice versa. It was invented to get in-laws. That is the purpose of marriage throughout history. Now, we laugh because, of course, for us, your idea of marriage is this tight conjugal relationship, and the interfering in-law is, you know, the worst thing that can happen. But in fact, if you go back in history, marriage was a way of making alliances. You go back to the earliest band-level societies, and you see over and over again that there are these marriage rules that tell people to marry out and to make an alliance. The New Zealand Maori say that you can make peace with other bands in many ways. You can have rituals, you can have feasts, but one of the surest way is to bring to form a marriage between people from two different groups. In ancient the Anglo-Saxon word for wife meant peace weaver, and you see that over and over again. Now, in societies that were very simple, then that was there wasn't a lot of pressure. Let's say that I'm in group A over here, and I want to make an alliance with group B. And as long as we're both basically pretty equal, I can allow my child. I can say to him, "You're not going to marry one of these people in group A, but basically you've got some choice from group B." But once you develop big differences in wealth and social status, then it becomes very consequential who you marry. If I'm one of the leading 15% or I have a claim to leadership in group A, I don't want my child just marrying anyone in group B. I want them to marry somebody at least as wealthy and social status as me, and perhaps, ideally, even more. So that marriage then becomes, at this point in history, in fact, one of the funnest things about researching my book in history, I felt like I'd been turned loose. Like it was like a National Enquirer assignment to be, get all the gossip I could, because the more I read Anthony and Cleopatra, so not a love story. Oh my gosh, for thousands of years, marriage was the way that families maneuvered to get connected in-laws. For the very wealthiest, it was the way of signing peace treaties. Making military alliances. Literally, people said, "Okay, we'll have peace. I'll give you this daughter," and often they left the name blank because they hadn't decided which daughter they were sending out to do that for. It was a way of ensuring your claim to social status. You know, if I'm descended from Charlemagne, I want my child to marry someone also descended from Charlemagne so that they've got a double claim to the throne. It was a way of affecting business mergers for the middle classes as well. You know, not on such a great scale, but the same thing. It was a business and political alliance. Until the late 18th century, the dowry, a European guy or an American too, received at marriage was usually the biggest infusion of cash that he would get before his own parents died. So he was often much more interested in the dowry than the daughter. And for the daughter, you know, just as parents today say now we try to educate both genders. We send them to school. We say, you know, do your homework because we're going to send you to college because that's our investment in your future. Well, providing a dowry for the man that you chose was the way you invested in your daughter's future. And just as we don't say to our teenagers, oh, go ahead, it's your choice whether you finish high school or do your homework or whatever, they said, you know, no, it's not your choice who you marry. We're gonna choose. Sometimes for our own advantage, very often for their own advantage, sometimes for their daughter's security. But at any rate, it was not something you left to individual decisions of young people on the basis of such a frivolous notion as, oh, I love you. It was true also for the lower classes. Some historians have argued that the lower classes were the people who had the luxury of marrying for love, but not at all. I mean, a farm or a business could not be run by one individual. You had to have some. That's why bakers married bakers, shoemakers married shoemakers. You married somebody who had good work skills, who had a strong arm if you were in the farm, maybe who had connected in-laws, maybe who had land near you. That's who you wanted to marry. Even when you had the choice, you didn't marry for love. No, I mean, what kind of crazy person would hire and fire your most important employee on the basis of your physical and mental attraction to them, you know? So for thousands of years, what's love got to do with it could have been the theme song for most weddings. And then in the late 18th century, it began to be respectable, not just, you know, a little rebellious thing that people did or a dream that they had. There began to be this new idea that young people, the idea of enlightenment, that the older generation and then the state shouldn't dictate to the younger generation. The spread of wage labor made it more possible for young people to defy their parents. You won't give me a dowry? I'll go work until I can get it. And then along came the French and the American Revolution, the radical idea of the Declaration of Independence that people are entitled to the pursuit of happiness, even in their personal lives, you know? And you got these new ideas that young people should, that the older generation shouldn't veto the choices of young people, and that they should be encouraged to marry for their personal satisfaction, to pursue their happiness. And you know, one of the funniest things researching this book is that social conservatives of the day, defenders of what was then the traditional marriage of political and economic convenience, were absolutely horrified at this new radical idea. They were saying, like, oh my gosh, if we tell people they can marry for love, you know what's going to happen when I try to get my son married off and he goes, "Ew, I don't love her," you know? If we marry for love, what's going to stop people from demanding the right to divorce? You know, and sure enough, no sooner was the idea of marrying for love did that begin to get bruited about that people began to say, "Well, then why would you stay in a marriage that didn't have love and didn't have mutual care?" Some people even said, why should we have these huge penalties against illegitimacy? Because after all, isn't it more immoral to enter a loveless marriage just because you ended up pregnant than to have the child yourself? And in fact, one of the French Revolution slogans of the French Revolution, which was freedom of marriage, they had playing cards that they passed out, equal inheritance. Oh, that was the other big thing that really worried people even more than divorce. If we tell people to marry for love, what in the world's going to happen to the male dominance that has been the mainstay of marriage for all these years, you know, when guys are going to start giving in to their wives if they love them. So there were all of these worries, and the French Revolution could have brought them to the fore. They said, you know, marriage, freedom of marriage, you should be able to marry whoever you want. Freedom of divorce, you should be able to divorce if you fall out of love. Equal inheritance for males and females, so you don't have to marry, the woman doesn't have to marry for because she doesn't have any money. And they abolished illegitimacy, and one of the slogans of the French Revolution was, there are no bastards in France. So, of course, and in America, too, there was this surge of radicalism about these issues, but it turns out that the traditionalists, their worst fears were not realized immediately. They were terrified. I mean, they essentially said, "Oh my gosh, this love is going to be the death of marriage," and they had a point. It was a radical, destabilizing ideology, but for 150 years, it was held in check by the ability of elites to penalize people who had non-conforming marriage lives, by the lack of birth control and the tremendous penalties for illegitimacy. As late as 1968, a child in America born out of wedlock could not collect debts owed to the mother, could not collect an inheritance owed to the mother, and could not sue for wrongful death if the mother was killed or maimed by a company so these were very severe penalties that held this in check. So of course were the legal subordination of women until the late 19th century. You know, the old marriage thing was invented in the 16th century. And the man says that with all my worldly goods I thee endow. Well, that's exactly the opposite way that actually marriage worked until the late 19th century. The law of coverture meant that when a woman married, everything she owned, even her personal jewelry, and anything she earned after marriage belonged to her husband. So we're not talking about any much maneuvering room for women here. Even after coverture began to be overturned, these head and master laws persisted right up until the 1970s that really limited the ability of women to make decisions independently. And so did the, of course, the lack of economic dependence on women. My latest book sent me back to the early 1960s to look at the laws that were surrounding women. Why this book, The Feminine Mystique, which some of you may not have heard of, but which at the time made this tremendous splash, and which was in fact this very unradical book. You know, it just said over and over again, women are people, too. They have their own, you know, and it was like, oh, my gosh, who would say that? Well, I went back to the 60s to understand why that was so radical, and I was, even I, who lived then, I was in college in the 60s, was stunned by the sorts of things that constrained women's choices. If you wanted to get a job, you had to go to the help wanted female segment of the section of the newspaper, and it was taken for granted that women would be paid fewer wages, so that as late as 1970, a woman with a college degree working full-time year-round earned $1,000 less a year than the average white male high school dropout, okay? So it's not much chance that women were going to start grabbing this banner of freedom and saying, I'm going to marry for love. Similarly, they had very few options in terms of divorce. There were only 8 states in America as of 1963 where a homemaker had any legal claim at all upon her husband's earnings. The only way, if there was a divorce, that she could get something, people idealized this idea of the days of fault divorce, was if she could prove fault, which was harder to do for a woman than for a man. And if not, she was entitled to nothing, absolutely nothing. Even the 8 states that had community property gave the men usually the power to determine where it would be invested, and in several of them, the man could leave his share of the community property, but the woman could not, to someone else. So there were all of these laws. It was a man's right to determine if his wife could take a job in some states, if she could take out a credit card in all states, where the couple lived, If he moved and she refused to follow him, he could charge her for desertion and get a fault-based divorce. So it's no wonder that the radical implications of the love match did not immediately take off. In fact, contrary to what most people think, men embraced the love match earlier than women did because they were more free to do so. Women had to be very conscious. I read so many diaries where they'd say, well, you know, my heart inclines to John here, but it's going to be safer to marry Harry over here. And as late as 1967, only 5% of college men, but two-thirds of college women interviewed said they would consider marrying someone they didn't love if he met all their other criteria, most of which had to do with social respectability and financial security. But of course, once you got the laws overturned that subordinated women, once you got equal pay laws, once you got women having access to education and work, and once you began to get higher standards for marriage, all of the destabilizing implications that the traditionalists had worried about began to come into play. And I want to tell you just one more example of what those expectations were like until about 30 or 40 years ago. When I was researching this new book, I was, for thousands of years, men had the right to physically abuse or correct, as it was, their wives. It wasn't until 1864 that the first American state held that a man did not have the right to correct his wife, but they said the proper remedy is to close the curtains and let them work it out for themselves. Wasn't until 1897 that the British courts ruled that a man could not imprison another British citizen, even if she was his wife. But even after it began to be formally illegal for domestic violence, domestic violence was not taken seriously. In the 50s and 60s, many police departments still had what they called the stitch rule. Yeah, it had to require a certain number of sutures, or the police had to see it before they could make an arrest. And in terms of taking it seriously, I found so little discussion of domestic violence when I was researching this book. But finally, I found this one journal put out by the American Medical Association in 1964 that had a case study of 30 or something, I forget exactly how many, domestic violence cases. I thought, oh boy, great. You know, they were taking it seriously then, so I started to read. And they had this, it was five psychiatrists wrote this. They had this long discussion of the patterns, and they pointed out that often this abuse had gone on for years and years and years and was only discovered and brought to the attention of the police when a teenage child intervened, usually a boy, trying to protect his mother. And instead of reacting, you know, I was like turning the page thinking, oh boy, now, you know, they're going to say the obvious, right? How sad this was that it didn't. No. Their reaction was that this intervention by the child disturbed a marital equilibrium that had been working more or less satisfactorily. Because in their analysis, these women were also, quote, efficient, that was their word, efficient and aggressive, that it destabilized the marriage, and so it was necessary both for the woman and the man to have this periodic correction of the marital situation. So I hope that I've spent enough time on here that I've maybe put a few darts in the punctures in the old balloon of just how wonderful it used to be. But there's been a tremendous paradox of the changes that have occurred since the late 60s and the early 70s. The same as women have begun to get more choice about entering a marriage or leaving a marriage, as men and women alike have developed higher standards of what makes for a good marriage, you have this tremendous paradox. A marriage, when it works, is fairer, more fulfilling, more passionate, more loving, more based on friendship than any of the marriages that I studied through 4,000, 5,000 years of history. Not more, well, maybe one or two, you know, except, but more than anybody would dare to hope. You know, if you got a loving marriage, that was gravy. It wasn't the bread and butter of and meat and potatoes of marriage then. But a marriage, when it doesn't work, seems less bearable to people. and people see are less willing to enter a marriage unless they're absolutely sure that it's work. So the same things that have strengthened marriage potentially as a relationship have weakened marriage as an institution. And marriage is no longer the only game in town. As people, one of the things that makes marriage good is that we have choices. I mean, what makes for a strong institution, right? Everybody has to enter it. You can't say, well, I'll pay, I'm not going to I'm not going to pay my taxes unless you're a big corporation, but then you get an excuse for it. You can't say, if I'm a guy, I'm not going to register for the draft, thank you. Or I will register for the draft for this war, but not for that war, thank you. Or I'll pay taxes for this, but not for that. What makes for a strong institution is everybody, the rules are the same for everybody. They don't change over the course of your life, and they apply to everybody. But if I may say so, that makes for a fairly crappy relationship. What makes for a good relationship is you have a choice whether to enter it or not. You can leave it if it ceases to work for you. You can negotiate it. It can change as you age. Those things make for a good relationship, but they destabilize marriage as an institution. And that's the huge paradox that we're facing in America and that we have to wrap our head around. And what it means, and I'm going to spend a few minutes wrapping up that, and then we'll just open it up to questions. It means a couple of important implications. For one thing, because marriage is no longer the only game in town, it means that some people will choose not to marry or they'll choose to leave marriages. And historian Nancy Cott has an analogy that I think is really good. She compares it to the disestablishment of religion. You know, when the Church of England ceased to be the established religion, it used to be that you had to be in the Church of England to hold political office, to get all sorts of privileges in England. Well, when they disestablished the Church of England, religion didn't disappear. But many new sects began, many new religions began, and even the Church of England didn't disappear, but it had to recruit and retain members in a very different way than in the past when it was the only game in town. And that, I think, is what's happening to marriage. And the ways that we have learned to recruit and retain people are in many ways an improvement. But there's also a downside to it, every change in history has trade-offs, that those higher expectations of marriage, the new things that recruit and retain people in marriage, are less accessible to those people, especially those people who are the victims of the increasing social inequality in our society. So the fact that it's harder to support a family, to enter a family, to come into a family, and to keep a marriage going without debt, harder for men to have the breadwinning status that they used to have, all of these things have destabilized marriage among lower income Americans at the same time as they have been restabilizing marriage among more highly educated and higher income Americans. We can talk in the discussion, if we want, about the growing have and have not gap in marriage, which is not caused by them lower income people not valuing marriage. They actually value it very much, and they often say they will not marry because they don't want to divorce. They want to make sure that they have the economic and emotional stability. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to end by talking a little bit about some of the good news for marriage for, I think, a lot of the people in this room, people who have been to college or are going to college. There's some of these changing rules of marriage are really exciting. It's fun to study because the rules are changing so fast. The things that used to make a marriage work no longer make a marriage work. The things that used to predict divorce no longer predict divorce. For example, if you wanted to make sure your marriage lasted in the 1950s, then you wanted to marry a man who had a very strong belief in male breadwinning. He was going to be more responsible. He was going to take care of you. These unconventional beatniks were a very bad choice. But nowadays, men who hold to strong ideals of male breadwinning are much more likely to divorce or maybe to be divorced than men with more unconventional ideas. Back in the 50s and 60s, as late as the 70s and 80s, this is how fast it's changing, when a woman took a job that destabilized the marriage. Today, when a woman takes a job that stabilizes the marriage. In the 60s and 70s, divorce rates rose as women entered the workforce. Today, the lowest divorce rates tend to be in the states where there are the largest numbers of working wives. Also in the 1960s, if you were a woman with an education, you often had to choose between having an education and having a stable family life. Today, for the gap in marriage rates between highly educated and less educated women has narrowed almost to the point of diminishment. There's still slightly more likely, a highly educated woman is slightly more likely to stay single all her life, but she is so much less likely to divorce that by age 35 or 40, women who earn high incomes or have high education are much more likely to be married than their less educated or less affluent counterparts. So there's been a total reversal there. So all of these things are good news for people who do bring the new emotional and economic resources to marriage to negotiate it. And marriage is a tremendous benefit to those kind of people. But it also has challenges even for those of us where the divorce rate has been falling. And I want to just talk a little bit. I want to take off my history hat and talk a little bit about some of the research I get to see in the Council for Contemporary Families about some of the things that make for good marriages today. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not trying to play one, even on TV. But I do want to share with you some of the fun things that we've been finding. First of all, there's a huge difference in terms of what it takes to sustain a good marriage nowadays. Back in the 1950s, half of all marriages began after only 6 months knowing each other. Less than 6 months. It was the majority. A large number of them were undertaken to legitimate a premarital conception, by the way. This is now one of the biggest risk factors for divorce, short knowledge, short time knowing each other, marrying to legitimate a premarital conception, huge risk factors for divorce. It used to be that marrying at an older age was considered to be a risk factor. If there was a difference, especially if the woman got older, that she was considered to be more set in her ways. Now, for every year a woman postpones marriage right up until age 35, her risk of divorce goes down and it doesn't start going up again. But I'm more interested by some of the changes in what makes for marital satisfaction. I've interviewed a lot of couples from the 50s and 60s, and many of them had really good marriages and friendships. But you didn't have to be good friends to get married then. And you could develop a perfectly satisfactory marriage, I think, on the basis of just adhering to strict gender role stereotypes. You know, my wife, she doesn't understand what I do. She she's such a good mom. And there was real respect in there, so she conforms. And you would have women who told me, well, my husband, he doesn't know how to deal with the kids and he doesn't understand my moods, but he's such a good provider. Well, that doesn't cut it anymore. As men and women marry at an older age with more experience, with more options outside marriage, their marriage needs to be based on friendship in a much deeper way than ever before. And I'm going to give you an example of that from John Gottman's work, predicting what works in marriages and what leads to divorce. But I also want to just tell you one interesting study about changing women's changing expectations. It's become more and more important for women that men share child work and housework, child care and housework. And it's such an important predictor. The first one is how emotionally responsive a man is to the woman, and And a lot of research suggests that that means, does he respond when she asks for change in the marriage? Is he willing to talk about it, or does he go into defensive mode? But the second biggest predictor is how fair she feels the division of housework is. And I often get, you know, kind of grumbles from the guys in the audience saying, you know, well, you're just letting them, you know, you're just telling women to ask even more of me. But I have some research that ought to make everybody happy here. It's like your classic win-win situation. For men, I told you that for women, the two biggest predictors are emotional responsiveness and fairness in the division of labor. For men, two of the biggest predictors of marital satisfaction are how much sex the guy gets and how little criticism he gets. And guess what? We have a ream of studies that show that women feel less critical and more sexually attracted to men who do housework and childcare. So this is a nice win-win situation, a take-home message for you. But I want to end with talking about one of my favorite studies, and that is John Gottman's. John Gottman is a psychologist at the University of Washington who's been tape recording newlyweds for years and years and years. The press call it his love lab. He's got this little apartment looking over the lake, and he tapes their interactions, and then he goes back. Now, Malcolm Gladwell, and I think even John even actually said it, and Gladwell was quoting him accurately, says, well, he can predict within 30 seconds, you know, whether a couple's going to last. That's not true. That is not true. But what he has found, looking back retrospectively, is there is a very interesting pattern, a very clear difference between those couples that eventually divorce and those that stay together. And he was telling me that when he first started doing this, he thought that a difference might lie in, you know, how intimate they are, how, well, you know, what their conversations were like, how disclosing they were, or how they fought, you know. But he said, no, actually, there are these totally mundane interactions between couples that turn out to be more predictive than anything else. And he calls them bids for attention. Little things like somebody says that they're eating breakfast and somebody says, pass that jam, that's really good jam, isn't it? Or they look outside and they see the boat and they say, oh, look at that sailboat. So he's got his graduate students coding the responses on this, you know, and it's not a really sophisticated coding system. It's like neutral, negative, or positive. So a neutral one might be, you know, good, or, you know, yeah. A negative one would be, I'm trying to read here, you know. And a positive one would be, that is really good jam. Maybe we should buy some and put it, you know. Or, yeah, look at that boat. You know, remember when we went sailing that time? Let's do that again sometime. It turns out these bids for attention are huge predictors if there's a positive response to it. Of whether a couple will stay together. You mean the ones who had positive responses 85% of the time, none of them divorced. Ones who had positive responses less than 50% of the time, almost all of them divorced. And I really related to this, and I'm going to tell you, since my husband isn't here, I'm going to tell you my own story with it. Because we have this, I tend to get up very early and just start to work. And when I work, I'm kind of laser. Like, I go through the news. I have three newspapers I read, and I'm only looking for stuff that's relevant to my work. He sits down with every paper. He reads it all the way through. He reads The New Yorker. I cannot bear to read these long articles in The New Yorker, but he gives me cliff notes about them. And he's also very respectful of my work. But he has his own little bids for attention, you know. So I'll be up there. I've been up since 6 o'clock writing away. He gets up. He gets his tea, and he sits down, and pretty soon he goes, ha, you know. And I didn't know before I had this read the Gottman studies and talked to Gottman that was a bid for attention. But before I knew it, I tended to respond positively. Not because I'd been trained, not because I'm a therapist, but because I know, A, he respects me and doesn't just, you know, do this to get my attention away from my work. And there are guys who do that. I've seen them. It's either because it's very funny, and he has a much better sense of humor than I, so, you know, the only laughter I get is when he, you know, says something funny that I wouldn't bother reading. So I tend to respond positively. Or also, if he says like, huh, and doesn't laugh, you know, it's a huh, like surprise, it's usually going to be something I want to know. For example, one of the best stories I got out of my about 50s families was that he read in an obituary in the New York Times of this woman, Koya Knudsen, who had been a very early legislator. Now, I would never read the obituaries, but because I, you know, responded positively to his bid for attention, I got something good out of it. So before I read Gottman, you know, I probably responded positively at least 80% of the time. You know, now I try to up it a little bit, you know. Let's see if I can hit 86%, you know. But what I like about this research is maybe you could up it by, you know, from 80 to 85% by trying. But you could never up it by 50% to 85% by the efforts. Because pretty soon you would be going, yes, you know. And, you know, for all they say, you know, all the cliches that women like to do about how men aren't sensitive to cues, believe me, men know when they're being patronized. And, you know, this would be a recipe for disaster, reading this in a self-help book and trying to do it. You've got to start out with that friendship and mutual respect in a way, I think, that you really never did before. There are lots of things you can do to nurture your marriage relationship. Well, since I'm handing out advice like candy, I'll tell you two from happiness studies. It's the opposite of the usual advice, stay home and have a family meal together with your kids or just go out on a date night. Actually, the two things that predict, three things actually that predict really good interactions and happiness between couples are one, having sex, so send your kids out, and two, having dinner with friends, so make it a double date night, and then three, doing things that are challenging that neither of you have done before, because that sort of increases the excitement, and especially if they're a little bit risky, like kayaking or white, you know, something like that. So that would be my advice there. But my point is that you can. There are real limits to what you're going to learn from self-help books. You have to start out with a respect for equality and a respect for each other's individuality that was never before necessary in history. We don't have worse partners than we used to. We need to be better partners than we used to. And that's all because of this tremendous revolution in marriage. So I see that I have approached what I think is a humane limit. Perhaps I've gone past a humane limit. So I'm going to wrap it up and see if you have any questions or comments, okay? Thanks.
Because this is being taped by KIOS, I'm going to ask that if you have questions, you come forward and use the microphone that's here in the aisle.
One of my cousins, female, got divorced in the mid-70s. So she went from California back to New Jersey, where my grandparents had this summer place. Well, one by one, three of her aunts, including my mother, take her for a walk. They want to make her feel better. Say, oh, don't feel so bad. You know, it'll work out. You'll be okay. And then, one way or another, all three of them said, if times had been different, I would have done the same thing. Now, these are women who are married in the late 30s, somewhere in the 40s, and it's in sort of what we understand as 50s marriages. How common is it that women of that generation, by the time they're in their 60s in the 1970s, look around and suddenly realize that maybe they had missed out on some choices, there were opportunities that younger people have that they didn't have and they wish they'd had. Mm-hmm. Is that common?
Yeah, it's quite common. You know, when you look back at marriages in the 50s and 60s, and again, I don't want to make massive generalizations. Many of them are very good. And some of these marriages went through hard times and did get better. I don't want to, you know, I think you can just over-polarize this situation. But it's also true that some women and men ended up spending 40 or 50 years in really miserable situations. And when you act, Kathleen Gerson interviewed the kids of divorced and non-divorced families. And interesting things, a majority of the kids whose parents got divorced said that they wished their parents had stayed together. But about 45% said that they were really happy that their parents divorced. It made them better. And what was really interesting is almost 40% of the kids whose parents stayed together said that they wished their parents had divorced. And usually it was because they felt guilty about their mother's unhappiness in the marriage and the mother's sacrifice that she was making. So I don't like to give once over-the-counter advice. I think that's very bad medical and sociological and historical practice. But I'm very adamant that the overgeneralizations we get on either side are just not helpful, you know, these averages. And we're finding it everywhere, you know, like cohabitation. Oh, gosh, you go on the website of the National Marriage Project, which is very, very pro-marriage, and will tell you all the worst associations with divorce, the correlations without examining the closet. They also have all of these correlations with cohabitation. And I was on a panel with one of them, and he was saying that, well, look at this. Domestic violence rates are much higher among cohabitors, so marriage protects you from domestic violence. And they are much stronger around cohabitors, but did it never occur to him that the fact that they have domestic violence may be why one of them is resisting marriage? And that it wouldn't solve the problems if we convinced them to get married. There is this misuse of cause and correlation that is just scary.
How do you see the economy affecting the marriages?
Well, and economics affects marriages in many ways. Economic stress has actually become a better predictor of marital distress than it used to be, and it was always some predictor. Economic stress leads to real deterioration in patterns and what, you know, just as the economy operates on the extension of credit, so do marriages operate on the extension of credit. And people under economic stress forget what is going well in marriage or with their kids and tend to respond explosively to what is going poorly, which is a real problem. The other way that economics really factors into marriage is in the growing rates of non-marriage among low-income people. And there's a wonderful paper, again, on the council. It sounds like I'm just, plugging the council whenever I get a chance, but this is why I plug it, because there are all these wonderful papers on it. And one of them is by Catherine Eden and Paula England that looks at why cohabitors who have a child together don't get married. And what they found, I love it because it's sort of a nice combination of the liberal and conservative cliches. On the one hand, the liberal cliche that it's the economy, stupid, seems to be really important. These men and women say that they don't want to get married until they're not dependent on their state or on the parents or whatever. They want to have a shot at making an independent go as a couple. And of the couples that met their very modest economic bar, 80% of them went ahead and married. But of the couples that didn't marry, didn't meet that economic bar, and broke up, it wasn't money that drove them apart. It was poor relationship skills. And so to my mind, that is such a nice way of cutting through the usual conservative liberal food fight on these issues. You have to provide jobs and financial security and a safety net for people. But you also should be providing relationship skills. And I just, usually people are just it's one or the other, and it seems to me just ridiculous.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by historian and sociologist Stephanie Kuntz, author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, and A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. The topic of her talk was Courting Trouble, The Past and Future of Marriage in America. Ms. Kuntz's remarks were given as the 2011 Richard Dean Winchell Lecture, sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of History. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 12, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Wendy Townley, Assistant Director for Media Relations at UNO, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.